Ruthie, host of Out There, here on Valley Free Radio. Tune in for stories from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond, Fridays from 4 to 5 p.m. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if we live
out of date. We don't care. And yes, indeed, it is Friday, February 6th, 2026. Is that right? Today, February 6th? Yeah, February 6th, 2026. Thanks for listening to Out There. And I'm live in the studio with another live guest, Haya Grossberg. Thanks for coming into the studio today, Haya.
Thanks for having me, Ruthie.
On this cold, cloudy, it was a pretty cold, cloudy, damp, icy kind of day today, if you ask me. I just got chills from getting my shingles vaccine yesterday. So Haya and I know each other from around town, Monday night potluck at the Flow Up. Haya is an author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs and some other books of poetry. What's the poetry books there you got, Haya?
I have Reborn, Poetic Codes for Psychiatric Survivors, and Daylily's Wild as Night.
And you consult with people who are trying to come off of psychiatric drugs. You got like a website, blogs, tell some stories, mm-hmm. and like story slams and all those things. Some of which we'll talk about on today's show. And also pets. We'll talk about some pets, pet issues, and our pets. I don't know, ethical issues around pet ownership and that kind of thing. Ownership. that book of poetry you said, it was kind of about like wildness or not unwildness. What did you say?
Yeah, it's about this Daylily's Wild as Night. It has a lot of different poems that are about the wildness within ourselves versus our domestication, which. Of course, pets also have their experience of, and then we kind of have roped them into our world of domesticated life. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think, you know, within each of us, there's also that struggle all the time of like, how free and wild can I be within this domesticated reality?
Mm. Yeah. My thoughts just flew my mind. Well, I was going to ask you a question. Now, what was that?
Well, I was talking a little bit about these sort of parallels between the way psychiatry relates with humans and the way we relate with animals as pets.
Mm-hmm. Well, we said we're going to talk about pets. So let's just keep talking about pets, maybe. I saw one of your videos yesterday when you were talking about, you know, pets and do they love you unconditionally? Different, like, psychological issue or the need that pets fill for mm-hmm. humans, and whether or not that's, I don't know, ethical or how. Do you have any pets?
I don't.
Have you ever had pets?
I have, yeah. As a kid, I had some newts and like little tank pets. You know, I had a frog that was in a little tank, and we had a turtle once in our summer house that just free roamed around the house, but we had actually pulled it out off the street and brought it into our house to be our house pet. I did have a cat once briefly.
Huh. How has your thinking around pets evolved?
It's evolved a lot because I've been allergic to cats, dogs, and dandery pets for my whole life. So hence the, you know, that I had these amphibians. But over time, I started to really think about it. I think at some point someone said to me, I wonder if your allergies are an empathic reaction to these animals. Hmm. And I started to think about what it actually was for an animal to be a pet. And the more I thought about what we have to do to make an animal docile enough to be a pet, the more I felt completely uncomfortable with the entire dynamic and realized that it wasn't, in my mind, the right relationship to have with an animal. And it's interesting because people often get very defensive about this when I mention it, if they are pet people, because I think of how much they benefit from this relationship. While at the same time, to me, it's not a real relationship because the pet doesn't have sovereignty. The pet has been forced to become dependent upon a human for life.
Well, like, isn't it kind of similar to children while they're children?
People say that, but no, because children are brought up to become free and sovereign and to then be able to make their own choices. I think what it would be similar to is if children were castrated or made impotent and forced to be dependent upon their parents for life and given like medications and things like that that would make them docile and, you know, unable to reproduce, unable to function on their own and have a life of their own, make their own choices.
It's interesting because when I think about your focus of helping people come off of psychiatric drugs, I feel like pets, for many people, pets are such a emotional support kind of thing. What if you got to choose between like a pet or a psychiatric drug?
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, again, it's like there are other options. You know, I think that people, because we've developed this over-reliance on pets as a society, people have actually forgotten how to get their basic needs met from each other in consensual ways, because anything where the need is met from a pet is non-consensual. Being a pet is already non-consensual from the beginning. I mean, obviously, yes, being a human, you could say, is also non-consensual.
I didn't choose to be born.
But I think it is different when, like, one species, you know, takes another species and you know, makes them impotent, makes them unable to reproduce, makes them docile and able to be put into our homes versus like a human. The goal of parenting and childhood is to make a child self-sufficient and able to live and make their own choices and have their own life. But in terms of the benefits, yeah, like people get from pets, I think one of the issues is that there are like a lot of those benefits actually could be gotten consensually from other humans. It just takes effort and it would be more of an actual real relationship. So like, for example, if somebody really wants to have a pet to cuddle with whenever on demand, whenever they want to, we could as a society acknowledge that we have this need to cuddle. We have this need to be like cuddle buddies with each other, perhaps, or maybe like, yeah, because there's no wild animal that's just going to come up to you and cuddle with you all day, you know, like they might for a minute, but then they're going to want to be free and do their own thing. They're not going to say, oh, please let me be a domesticated pet and like made into a docile animal. Just so you can cuddle with me all day, you know. Yeah. But then like with humans, it's like you have to ask consent. But there actually are a lot of humans that also do like to cuddle all the time. So if they could find each other and find those connections, that would be a more ethical way to get those needs met.
It seems like in reality, it would be a lot trickier than that, because I mean, like human beings are so complicated and all the communication that goes into it and really like being sure that you really have consent. That just seems exhausting. It's just better to have a cat.
Well, you could say it's exhausting, but at the same time, think of how exhausting it must be for the cat to like not to have been forced into that role.
Generations of being bred to be docile, I feel like it has happened, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, it seems like the cat.
I mean, just because it's easier, it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. Yeah. Like, it would also maybe be easier to have a slave versus paying somebody to help you with things.
But it seems like, you know, cats that like to cuddle these days, like, they love being stroked and they love all that. They just really love it.
A lot of people do too, honestly. Yeah. You know, you just have to find your people.
Yeah.
And they love being, but like, the thing is, they love being stroked, but again, because they're in such a limited situation that that's all they have. Mm. You never meet a wild cat that just comes up and wants you to stroke them all day.
Yeah, I guess usually the same person that's doing the stroking often also gives the cat food and shelter.
Right.
And all those things.
Yeah.
And your little video thing where you were talking about unconditional love and you're saying, no, animals don't love you unconditionally. can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, people like to say that their pets love them unconditionally, but look at all the conditions that are there. The pet has no other choices. Literally zero.
Sometimes pets could run away.
Yeah, they do sometimes.
Yeah, they do sometimes. But in terms of having, like, yeah, in theory, you could cuddle with human beings, but it's, what if, like, people are so isolated, though, and the pet's, like, there in your house when you get home. And if you live in a rural area, it's hard to find other human beings. It's hard to connect with other human beings transportation issues. The pet's already just there.
But it's only there because of this long history of co-opting animals into that role, you know? So again, like, there's karma around that too. It's like, you can't just co-opt an animal and use it without thinking there won't be any repercussions, you know? Or like I can just use this for my needs. I mean, yes, it might be complicated for people to relearn how to not be isolated, but I think that that's like the core of our work as humans.
Right.
And if we keep outsourcing that to pets, it's like just procrastinating what we really need to do, which is to actually learn how to relate with each other. So it's like it could be actually furthering that isolation, because if everyone has a personal animal that they've used as a pet, then they don't actually need to learn those skills and those communications and to have consent and to get those needs met in ethical ways that aren't harmful to an animal.
Where do domesticated animals or farm animals tie into all this? Or like, say, dogs that have a purpose, like a guard dog. I mean, cats, cuddle cats have a purpose too. But I'm thinking about like farm animals or work animals. Or food eating chickens.
Yeah.
All those things.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's really like such a spectrum. I think there's like a full spectrum of how much we've domesticated animals, you know, and then there are these like grayer areas along where like we have a food chain and all animals do eat one another, or not all, but a lot of animals eat one another. So there's something about that that seems like it's inherent in our biology. At this, and like, of course, as humans, we've created so many systems, you know, like involving animals and what we use them for. So, you know, I don't have like all the answers for every single level of domestication that we've created. I do think that if an animal at least can be outside all day, that's better than like actually bringing it into our house and forcing it to be inside all day. But of course, there are many unethical farm practices and unethical practices that we do with animals all the time. So, Yeah.
What about the environmental impacts of pets, pet food, cat litter, all that?
Well, I have read that apparently pets contribute more to global warming than cars because of the way that pet food is manufactured. I don't know everything about that topic, but it is something that I've read. And another issue is like, what we feed pets, because if pets were in the wild, they would be eating you know, wild plants and other wild animals. But the type of food that a lot of people are feeding their pets is like spam type, you know, fake meat products that are like really disgusting.
So the cats should just eat the wild birds.
And I mean, you know, of course, like a lot of people want to say like, oh, these pets have a so much better life living inside with me. I'm feeding them all day. They don't have to fend for themselves and all this stuff. But I just really don't think it's our place to say that, to interfere. You know, we don't. It's like, to me, it's like humans overstepping our role in animals' lives when we say like, I'm going to take this animal into my home, make it unable to reproduce, docile, like, and even the whole veterinarian system, again, going back to psychiatry, like a lot of pets are on psych meds now.
I'm not
kidding. It's really common. and they definitely like get put on psych meds for various things. And this sort of whole behaviorism, especially around dogs, because of how much dogs are like not really, you know, as easy to subdue as cats, as easy to make docile. Like they don't become house pets as easily. They still need to go outside. They still need to run around a lot more than cats do and other pets do. And then like how that intersects with society, there's a whole bunch of other issues there.
Yeah, like if they have nowhere to run around and all that, they get a little cabin feverish. Is that the kind of like psych meds, animal psych, dog psych meds that you're thinking of?
Well, they're very, I don't know exactly why and what animals get put on psych meds for, but I know it's a huge thing. Like they're put on antidepressants, they're put on benzos, they're put on like almost all the same psychiatric medications that humans are put on. And also just with the whole veterinary system where veterinarian, whatever, you know, animals going to the vet, just, again, it's like we're interfering so much in animals' lives. We're like subjecting them to our medical system. And then like to just all the other toxic elements of our society that they get subject to, like like if their owners smoke cigarettes or if their house is full of chemicals and just like all these things that the animal never has any say in and never will have any say in, you know. You know, and then there are, of course, people that like really, a lot of people would argue they really do their best to treat their pets well and that they give their pet a good life and things like that. But at the same time, I think they're kind of kidding themselves because no matter how much you try to give a pet a good life, like it still, I don't think, is the right relationship to have with an animal from the beginning. And like a lot of people also have excuses and reasons and like, well, but this pet, like, you know, was a rescue or, you know, they really needed, you know, whatever. And like, of course, you know, in this current society that we're in now, there are just so many pets that are, that have unfortunately gotten to the point where they need something. And, but, you know, there are thoughts that I've, conversations I've had with people about what would it take to rewild animals. And I'm not an expert on that topic, but I think a lot of people just want to shut down that conversation. Like pets could not be rewilded. They need us now because people don't want to, you know, consider, people don't want to have to consider that it might even be possible.
Yeah. I haven't looked at the statistics, but anecdotally, it feels like the trend is fewer kids and more pets. And I think what you said about isolation and human beings, like us losing skills to be closely connected with each other and connecting with pets instead, that really, that resonates with me. Anyway, should I play the song? All right, this is by Porno for Pyros called Pets. Do you want to say what it's about for people like me who can't understand the words? If they can listen for the words?
I think the lyrics are pretty simplistic, but it's basically about how humans would make great pets if we were the ones being pets to Martians.
Yeah.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I have a live guest in the studio, Haya Grossberg. And we're talking about, well, we've been talking about pets. Haya, you've got a poem there that you wrote. Can you share that?
Sure, thanks. This is called Daylily's Wild as Night. It's from my recent poetry book. This is the title poem. So the book itself is also called Daylily's Wild at Night. And I just want to say I had a really good fortune of reading this poem and another one from this book at the Straw Dog Writers Guild Authors Showcase at Forbes Library this past weekend, which was a wonderful experience. So I will read this poem. I remember life before cars and when there was no such thing as a hashtag or an online post or even a telephone. No such thing as a fully domesticated cat or dog on a leash. I remember when it was me and the wild rosebuds, the chimpanzees swinging alongside me when I walked and went about my day, the daylilies wild as night. And when there were no Pampers or pads, we bled straight down into the dirt and grass, and things got moldy all the time. And we were not responsible for having the right potions, though sometimes we did. But it was not expected so much. So much less was expected of us, and we walked around aimlessly sometimes, like that was normal and expected, like the red flowers of spring leaping off their vines to kiss me smack on the lips. The wild dogs of summer running the fields, before there were breeds of dogs who knew sit and stay, on leash, off leash, before there were cats curled up in sunbeams for hours, before there were bowls even for water or grocery bought things, or have there always been bowls of some kind? Even my two hands together form a bowl that can hold a little water that I can drink or share with a wild animal or splash on my face, in my hair, on my chest, between my legs, behind my back, up and down my legs, behind my ears, up and down my arms, from the stream, sitting on a rock, without shoes or a shirt or underwear or anything at all, a wild animal myself.
When did you write that?
A couple of years ago.
Do you want to say anything more about it?
I just think it's a lot about that, like what I was talking about in the beginning, that tension that I think we as humans feel as well between our wildness and our own domesticated situation here on this planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like that yearning. I feel like as a writer, it's like it often comes out in my writing, this yearning to reconnect with like those little bits of wildness, those feelings of connection with the natural world that wild animals have a lot more access to.
Well, before that poem and the music, when we were talking about pets, and you'd said, you know, what if an elephant wanted to have us as a pet or something? You know, what if some other species, like just to have to practice, do that creative exercise, just imagine another animal having us as a pet.
Yeah. Like imagine being a pet and an elephant, you know, castrated you, made you unable to reproduce. Maybe gave you some drugs to make you docile, and then you were like in an elephant den just being pet all day, and they would feed you, and
you'd have to make the best of it. So, but what about, say, like service animals, seeing eye dogs, emotional support animals, all that?
Yeah, it's a topic I've thought about a lot, partly because I am allergic to animals, to dogs, and you know, other animals, but it's mostly dogs that get they get put into the service animal role, although sometimes cats do too. I've noticed it happens occasionally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been an interesting progression because I remember when I was a kid, it was like there might be occasionally a seeing eye dog that you would see. And now it's like service dogs are everywhere and it's pretty easy for anyone to access a service animal. Or I've definitely also known people that would kind of turn their pet into a quote unquote service animal, but only use it as a service animal when they wanted to. And then once that pet died, they no longer apparently needed a service animal anymore. So yeah, I think there is a lot of kind of gray area and slippery slopishness around the service animal situation, but also this lack of respect for people with allergies because so many service animals are not hypoallergenic. And then it becomes like such a difficult, it's become so difficult to access spaces when almost every space has had service dogs coming through that are not hypoallergenic. And that you're not really, and it's like, it does bring back this like issue around invisible disabilities versus visible disabilities, because if somebody has a service animal, that's a way of making disability visible by saying, this is my service dog or my service animal. And then somebody with an invisible disability, like they can't breathe when there's dog dander in the room, is kind of, their disability becomes downplayed because you can't see it.
Yeah. It seems hard to meet everybody's needs all the time. Yeah, I'm also thinking about, so I'm going to Trinidad in a couple weeks, my fourth trip in the last 6 years or so. And I'm thinking about the dogs in Trinidad, the dogs in the rural community that I go to. They seem to roam quite freely. They're not the kind of dogs. I mean, the houses there, many of the houses there, just the doors are kind of open. There's a free flow of air and people and animals and all that. But just thinking about the what a pet means there versus here in terms of having autonomy. I'm also thinking about canine, like work dogs. I don't know what category that falls into.
Yeah, another thing that's kind of, that again goes into this disability access question, is that dogs are being used more and more in hospitals, medical offices, therapy offices, making it nearly impossible for somebody with severe animal allergies to access those spaces. So it can become like a real issue of emergency, lack of emergency access or lack of healthcare access, which I've definitely experienced a lot of. And like, I've seen things with like people sort of celebrating bringing canine dogs into hospitals and into schools and things like that. And again, it's like, I don't think those dogs are hypoallergenic. The other thing is that most hypoallergenic dogs actually are not completely hypoallergenic. So it's still helpful to use a hypoallergenic dog because they're much, much, much less allergenic. But that doesn't mean they're completely non-allergenic, just for the record, because I am actually allergic to most of them, just not as much.
Are the hypoallergenic dogs more expensive?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know what the dog market is. Yeah, let's see. Well, let me play. So I'll play a winter song. This is Tori Amos, Winter.
Snow can wait, I forgot my mittens. Wipe my nose, get my new boots on. I get a little warm in my heart when I think of winter. I put my hand in my father's glove. I run off where the drifts get deeper. Sleeping Beauty trips me with a frown. I hear a voice, you must learn to stand up for yourself, 'cause I can't always be around. He says, when you gonna make up your mind? Discovered as winter melts, flowers competing for the sun, skating around the truth who I am. But I know, Dad, the ice is getting thin. When you gonna make up your mind? When you gonna love you as much as I do? When you gonna make up your mind? 'Cause things are gonna change so fast. All the white horses are still in bed. I tell you, I tell you that I'll always want you near. You say that things change, my dear.
Tori Amos with The Winter. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie. I'm here with my live guest, Haya Grossberg. Thanks for coming in today, Haya.
Thanks, Ruthie. It's great to talk to you.
And Haya is the author of multiple things, including Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs and a couple books of poetry that you got there, Haya. And you're working on a new novel.
I have been writing a novel for the first time over the past few years. It's called Clarissa's Hot Sauce. And it does tie in actually with both of these topics, but I'm going to focus a little on the psychiatric drug topic because the part of the original premise of this novel involved a friend of mine who died by psychiatric drug-induced suicide quite a few years ago, but he was about maybe 13 years ago. But he was a childhood friend of mine, lifelong friend at that time, and he died in his 30s. After having been put on a lot of psychiatric drugs, and yeah, he died by suicide. And he's a character in the novel, and the novel is, on some level, it's about a lot of different things, but on some level, it's like a different story of something else that could have happened in his life if he had been able to get off of those medications. And it also has a bit of a fantasy element to it. So
you've been working on that for a couple years? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about your process? Like, how do you write a novel?
Well, it's interesting because I'm in several writing groups. I was in several, now I'm really only in one, but I was in several writing groups at that time, and I had never written a novel before. So what I did was I only wrote it when I was in these groups, but I stuck with it. So I wrote it, two or three times every single week for about a year and a half. And every single time I just kept writing. And it started out with just a sort of random scenario that I came up with one day. And then I just kept writing and writing. And sometimes like things that came into my life and my realm would inspire these ideas. And I'd be like, yeah, I want that to go in my novel. And then what actually inspired me to write about Michael was that his ex, so I had written a blog about him around the time he died so many years ago. And everyone, but I put his full name so that people might, you know, if they, because he didn't have any internet presence and his name is Michael Bloom, but I put his middle name too, Michael Samuel Bloom, so that if anyone knew him, that they would know this was about him, because there was just like nothing out there about him. And mm-hmm. I wanted to, partly because I nearly died from psychiatry when I was very young, and I felt like I had this kind of second lease on life where I was able to then tell my story, and that a lot of people don't get that opportunity. Either they die or they just never are able to get out of the psychiatric system and have a voice again. So what happened was one of his ex-girlfriends had found my blog. And over the years, several of his friends and ex-girlfriends have found my blog and reached out to me. But this happened just a couple years ago when I was in the middle of actually already writing a novel about a different topic, this same novel. But she actually reached out to me and sent me like these very, very long, long, long detailed accounts of her relationship with him. And almost as if I was her diary, it was like pages and pages of her story of her relationship with him and how she was affected by the whole situation. And again, this is about 13 years or maybe at that time, like 11 years after he had died. And when I got her messages, I felt like this needs to be written about. So I like changed a lot of the details and I fictionalized it, but I started to create these characters like Michael and his ex-girlfriend. And I didn't like put anything true about her in it. You know, I kept it completely anonymous. But I started, it just inspired me to write this whole story. And then I just took it in a whole other direction of like the whole scenario that could have happened if some, you know, if it was different.
Wow. Can you share? Do you want to share any stories from it? Or is that like letting the cat out of that? Oh, cat analogies.
Well... Well, but like I said, the title is Clarissa's Hot Sauce. So part of the premise of the novel is that there's this hot sauce that's transformative and it puts people through a kind of transformative experience. And the other thing about Michael is that he was a mailman for a little while. And, you know, like I said, I'd known him our whole lives. So I knew him since childhood, since we were teenagers, young adults, you know, in college, everything. So he had this dream, this like goal when he was sometime in his early 20s about becoming a mailman. And he had this very idealized and kind of fantastical idea about what it means to be a mailman. And so there's also a character in the novel that kind of represents me, but again, it's very fictionalized and really very many things about her are not like me. So she's like kind of me, kind of not me. And Michael becomes her mailman. And then they meet each other. And there's also this spiritual detective agency involved, which is also connected with the hot sauce. So, yeah, there are several characters that end up embarking upon this kind of hot sauce transformative adventure together. And then another factor that comes in towards the end is that there's a spiritual law firm, which exists in connection to this spiritual detective agency, and it's on a blimp in the sky. And so like it starts to get more fantasy like. And so basically I'd spent about a year and a half writing the first draft, and then I sort of put it down for about a year. But during that time I was playing with it. Like I was creating some of the scenes, like I made some videos of some of the scenes and did some like open mics where me and my friends would act out a scene from this novel. So I was still exploring with it and kind of exploring how do I edit this. And I thought the first draft was completely done. But then in this past November, after it had been a year, I just started getting more inspiration again. I started writing again. And I'm not sure if this is a continuation of the first draft or maybe a sequel, maybe the next story. Uh-huh. But it's the same characters.
When you say like a spiritual law firm or a spiritual something rather that you said, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's like, so the pet thing eventually comes in there too. But starting with psychiatry, it's like, it's like kind of like things that we take for granted in society that might be legal and considered okay and fine and normal here, but that on a spiritual level or on a like a more on a deeper level are questionable ethically or like yeah, like maybe it's legal in our world, but it might not really be quote unquote spiritually legal. Mm-hmm. Like there's going to be a backlash or a ramification for certain things if they're robbing other people of their humanity and their sovereignty.
Yeah, I see where the pets are coming in now, but can you give another example?
With pets? Or with,
another
with
psychiatry? Example of like, you know, like something that might be legal, but not like ethically legal.
Not ethical, yeah, or not spiritually legal.
The things that you're
yeah.
thinking about connected to your book. I mean, there's a gazillion things.
Yeah.
A gazillion things. Like, right. Turn and look around everywhere.
Right, like exactly.
AI like, data centers.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but a lot of things, I guess in the book, it was a lot about psychiatry because it's such a big thing in psychiatry that it's like, it's almost like a legal form of drug dealing and getting people addicted to harmful substances. Mm-hmm. While, I mean, I know this has been being said for many years, but it's like there are a lot of kind of illegal versions of these substances that get people in jail and arrested. Mm-hmm. But then psychiatrists are making lots of money for prescribing this almost the same substances, but in a legal form, in a medicalized form with a diagnosis. And then that are actually really harming people a lot. So, yeah. And it's like there's always these questions of like, well, does the person know that they're harming others? A lot of times they might not. Yeah. But what are the ethics around even, you know, participating in a profession and not really knowing what it's actually doing to people, you know, not really taking the time to do that research and to learn from people who've experienced it.
I mean, I would think that a lot of the times psychiatrists are doing the best they can given the position that they're in and the whole like the system, the structure is all a lot of forces leave few options sometimes. Like people don't have the emotional support that they need. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting too because I think the idea also of a spiritual law firm goes even deeper to what's even okay in terms of how we're making our life choices, like even becoming a psychiatrist to begin with. And again, it's like it doesn't necessarily mean that that person had any bad intentions at any time, but like there is, well, I won't really get too far into it because it gets a little, it gets like really quite complicated, quite deep and like almost esoteric or like mystical in a way of like, well, like what's actually guiding us in making our decisions? And is it okay to not really, really tune in with something? And like, what are the energetics of it? What are the energetics of psychiatry? You know, or even thinking about what are the options and like, what does it mean to be a human being? And like, it's just, there are a lot of really more profound questions that maybe society doesn't encourage people to ask. And there are a lot of rewards for not even asking those questions. There are a lot of financial rewards, I should say, for not questioning things like that too much.
An example, I'm not really sure what you're talking about.
Well, I just mean like, you know, psychiatrists, for example, are pretty well rewarded in society. They have quite a bit of status. They make a good amount of money. But like, let's say street drug dealers don't. Yeah. Well, they might make a lot of money. But yeah. I don't know. Probably not too much, but maybe in some cases. But the point being that like there are pathways in society that have already been laid out pretty well and that might seem like a very convenient and like easy-ish way to make a lot of money and help people on a surface level. But there's like a backlash for not actually thinking about things on a deeper level and like what's actually happening for someone when they might go to a psychiatrist. Like a lot of questions really aren't asked in most cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm looking at your website and when you mention stuff around healing and intuition, you're talking about like this spiritual law firm and intuition and stuff like that. I don't know what, yeah, tell me why, what's healing and intuition? That's like a topic here. Please, on your newsletter information.
Intuition?
Yeah, what does that mean to you?
What is intuition?
What does that offer? Or what does that mean to you?
Healing and intuition. It's, I guess, my own experience has been throughout my life, I guess, having a very strong intuition. Mm-hmm. And like, I guess identifying as a healer or having this kind of, I guess you could call it even like a wounded healer kind of archetype of going through things, like going through my experiences with psychiatry, with psychiatric drugs nearly killing me, but somehow emerging from that with this sense, this like medicine that came out of that and this calling to share what I went through and to kind of embark upon this journey throughout life that I've been on since then, that's been very guided by a sense of intuition, but also the sense of like opportunities coming to me to use what I had experienced to reach out to others and share ideas that came to me through that.
Yeah. You know, I have these questions on the top of my head and they just kind of slip away. They just slip away. I think that shingles vaccine I got yesterday is still kind of wiping me out, my brain and everything. Oh, but you're listening to Out There. You're listening to Hiya Grossberg, a conversation between me, your host, Ruthie, and Hiya Grossberg. Do you want to say anything about things like story? What did I say? Like poetry readings? We had another poem in there too, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Events coming up for whatever we talked about before. Let's delete this from the record of history, my babbling. Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. You want to read that poem you were looking at?
Sure. I'll read this poem. This is actually a poem that I did write while I was going through what I mentioned, when I was on a lot of psychiatric medications. When I was quite young, I was maybe 20, 21. No, I was about 21, actually, when I wrote this. And it was a prophecy that I had about that I would recover. But at this time, I had been bedridden for about a year. And I had a drug fever. So there's something called neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is when you can get a long fever while on psychiatric drugs, like that doesn't have any infection associated with it. It's just a fever. And I had it for 3 months.
You said bedridden for a year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And actually longer than that, like this is, yeah, probably about 2 years when I was going through that on psychiatric medications. So this is the poem. It's called Want. Now things are well. They want to know about my journey. Were there rocks? Were there diamonds? How did you sleep on the slants of hills? All I have in my pockets is quiet, I say, and open my hand to their ear, to their footsteps. They want to eat chocolate with me and dance. They don't know what these things mean to me. If you step on a rock, get a degree in diamonds, you must hold their weight strong in your ear, in your footsteps. The world is full of brown and retreat, purple and history, clear and mystery. The world is full of Snickers bars and ballerinas, hospital potatoes, wheelchairs, writing and waiting and watching people work with a wonton of want. It's been called a wrestle and wonderful. I haven't been waiting. I haven't been watching. I wrinkle at the wonders, which has been called a withdrawal. I call it a wrap, a wash. So I can say something about that poem. Do you want to say anything?
No, go ahead.
I can just say something about that poem, which is that there was this sense that when I went through all of that, like where I was kind of in this cocoon, I was very isolated for a couple of years. I was on all these medications that were making me very sick and very fatigued and like unable to go to school or work or do anything or relate with people. But there was something about it that was like this, like a crucible, and I was having an almost like an extended near-death experience for many, many months. Where I didn't feel connected to anything in this world. And I actually felt very connected to like the heavens or people I knew who had passed on, or just like the sense of where I would be when I died. And yeah, so there was just this kind of, it was like a transformative time where I needed to, I think, for my own spiritual journey and purpose in life, like go through all of that, even though it had it took a really major toll on my body. You know, I basically have had adrenal fatigue like since then.
Well, I'm looking at the clock. 5 o'clock is coming up soon, which means Democracy Now at 5 o'clock. So I'm thinking maybe we'll wrap this up because I want to save some time for a song and some announcements.
Sure.
But Haya, this has been Haya Grossberg. Thank you so much for coming in today. And your book, Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. If anyone is looking for support, do you want to say a little bit about your support that you can offer people?
Yeah, for about 20 years, I've been professionally consulting with people who are seeking to come off psychiatric medications or looking for alternatives to them. I work with families, people of different ages, and I'm not a medical professional, but I've done a lot of trainings and I've worked with a lot of groups and a lot of people over the years to help them figure out like all the different pieces of that process of coming off psychiatric medications in order to, yeah. And it's like a slow and careful process. I don't pressure or rush anyone. I do everything very with a lot of consciousness towards where somebody truly is at this moment and what they want.
And if people want to get in contact with you?
Yeah, you can go to my website, HayaGrossberg.com. It's HayaGrossberg.com.
Or maybe they'll see you at a story open mic storytelling thing around or poetry reading or arts and crafts night, or who knows where they might see you around town.
Yeah, you never know.
All right.
Thanks, Ruthie.
Yeah, thanks for listening to Out There. This is Donovan, and I think we'll have some.
Your theory, know your time. Don't you worry, weather's fine. All the world knows what I'm saying. All the world knows what I'm saying. The world will find me.
Thanks for listening out there today. That was Donovan. Here's an announcement I want to make. So this is a great time of year to go by the Smith College Botanic Gardens. Well, actually, the whole Smith College is Botanic Garden, but it's really nice this time of year to go inside the plant house, the greenhouse plant house. And in the entryway, the display in the entryway is called Koanban Chinema, Do You See the Light in Me? And it features six Nipmuc artists, cultural and land stewards. Rachel Healing Willow Bayless and Willow Daly and Keely Curtis of Pequoig Farm, Scott Stronghawk Foster and Andre Strongbearheart Gaines Robertson Jr. and Kimberly Tony. That display at the Smith College Plant House is up until May 24th, 2026. There's corn and beans and squash and art and photography and a small model of a canoe, burned out canoe. What do you call it? You know, you burn the wood and you make a canoe hollowed out by burning. And like a shelter made out of bark and cedar branches and lashing. And also Andre Strongbearheart Gaines is going to be giving a talk at Smith College Monday, 3:05 p.m. in the, I think it's Graham Hall, in the art building on Elm Street. Yeah, they had a talk this past Monday that Gabby Immerman did that I went to. It was good. Anyway, you can stop by the Smith College Plant House for more information. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Oh, and there will be Bike Lab tomorrow, February 7th, 2026.